Chapter 11. Mrs. Bagthorpe praised her children highly when she heard that Mrs. Fosdyke was to resume her duties the following day. Mr. Bagthorpe greeted the news with a tempered enthusiasm. While prepared to admit that the household would run more smoothly than it had in her absence, he nonetheless thought the portrait for posterity foolhardy and ill-considered. "Once hung in guilt, she will become impossible," he predicted, "and she will probably demand a rise in her wages." The kitchen during the next few days certainly was to become more than usually Mrs. Fosdyke's exclusive territory, and this meant one less place of refuge for the Bagthorpes, already without a dining and sitting room. Mrs. Fosdyke was very keen that the background to her portrait should be right, and kept cooking mouth-watering things that she would not allow to be consumed until they had been immortalized in paint. Accordingly, much pressure was put on Rosie to get the portrait done as quickly as possible, but this she refused to do. This portrait was by far the largest yet commissioned, and she herself was unaccustomed to being framed in 19th-century gilt. Furthermore, Rosie well knew that her siblings had already started on their relentless pursuit of glory, and felt that if she could achieve a deathless portrait of Mrs. Fosdyke, she would at least be keeping up. "I shall send it to the National Portrait Gallery," she told everyone. "What for?" inquired William. William, as eldest, felt that it was important that he should achieve immortality sooner than any of the others. He was determined to carry through his idea of a non-stop tattoo, but was wanting an assistant. Clearly he would have to remain in his own room with the door shut, and equally clearly he would need sustenance during the long and arduous performance. 321 hours was a long time. Nobody wanted to volunteer to bring his meals up to him. "You'll have to take a bowl of fruit up," Tess told him. "That should at least keep you alive. Gandhi frequently lasted on less." William, unwilling to undergo this kind of deprivation, even in the interests of immortality, was reduced to suggesting to Grandma that Daisy be invited to stay for a few days. He in no way admired or trusted Daisy, but knew that the idea of trotting regularly up to the top floor bearing trays of food would appeal to her. Grandma said that she would love to have Daisy stay as long as she did not bring any maggots. William explained that the last of the maggots had gone to Mrs. Fosdyke, and Grandma accordingly telephoned the Knoll and invited Daisy to stay. After some persuasion from Uncle Parker, Aunt Celia reluctantly agreed to this, on the proviso that Daisy should be allowed to do exactly as she wished, and should not be spoken to harshly. Grandma readily agreed to these conditions, and went to tell the rest of the household about Daisy's forthcoming visit. The reception of this intelligence raised from the lukewarm to the frigid. Mr. Bagthorpe was absolutely against it, and said that Daisy was a bad influence on Grandma. "Mother is too old and too impressionable to be exposed to such company," he declared. Even Mrs. Bagthorpe was dubious. The following day, decorators were due to begin work on the burned-out dining-room, and she was hoping that this time the color scheme would be of her own choosing. The one good thing that had come out of the Christmas Day fire was that the toad-colored walls, perpetrated by the indefatigable Daisy, were now to be painted eau de Nil, as had been originally intended. Water of the Nile, possibly? I'm not sure. I don't even know. "I must warn the decorators," she said worriedly, "and myself ensure that all tins of paint are kept tightly closed." Mrs. Fosdyke requested that Daisy be kept out of the kitchen. Her attitude toward Daisy had softened since the letter of apology, but she was in no way convinced that Daisy's character had undergone any permanent change. "The leopard don't change his stripes," she said darkly. "And nor will she have." "She will come to the kitchen only for her meals," Mrs. Bagthorpe promised, "and we must try not to be too hard on her. She is, after all, only 4. "And getting older every day," returned Mrs. Fosdyke. "More's the pity." Tess, who would be spending most of her time holed up in her room, was not against the visit, though she would have been had she known the real reason for it. She thought Daisy was coming merely to keep Grandma company, and as yet knew nothing of the part she was to play in the marathon tattoo. What Tess intended to do was to write out the collected works of Voltaire by hand, in a record time. She did not know what the existing record time was, and it had occurred to her that perhaps one did not exist. This did not deter her. "If no one has done it before," she thought, "then my record will stand until someone breaks it." She wrote off a letter to the Guinness Book of World Records, appraising them of her intended feat, and informing them that the French teacher at her school would undertake to supervise. He had thought the idea a very good one, and said it would bring Tess's French on even further. Mr. Bagthorpe, on the other hand, said in his opinion Tess would end up by thinking she was Voltaire, and probably have to be committed to an asylum. By now Mr. Bagthorpe knew what his brood was about, and why. He was in favor, in principle, of his own offspring outshining those of the sainted aunt, but wished they could do it more quickly and quietly. "What you are lacking in," he told them, "is careless ease. There's altogether too much striving after effect." The only one of the younger Bagthorpes not now striving after effect was Jack, who thought his chances of attaining immortality infinitesimal. "In any case, old chap," he told Zero, "immortality is in a grain of sand, and in any case you are immortal. You're already immortal. You're a household word, and if Rosie sends Fozzie's portrait to the National Gallery, I'll get her to send ours as well." As soon as Daisy arrived the next day, William took her aside and explained to her what he wanted. "I am going to be in the Guinness Book of Records," he told her, "and you can have the honor of helping me." "Oh, thank you, William!" she cried. "Can I bang on some dumbs?" "Not now, Daisy," he told her, "but you can have a go when I've finished. What I want you to do is to bring my meals up to me on a tray. You can pretend to be a waitress." "Is that a good thing to be?" she asked. "A waitress?" "A very good thing," he assured her. "Will I get tired?" she asked. "I'm only little, and I might get tired, or I might forget." "You'll have to be really grown up," he said, "and try to remember." Daisy pondered the matter. Evidently, the idea of being a waitress did not appeal to her so strongly as he had hoped it might. She was, after all, used to doing things much more exciting than going back and forth up long flights of stairs with trays. "If I did forget," she mused, "I expect you'd starve." "Yes, I would," William said, in the mistaken belief that this would force her into an affirmative decision. "If you did starve," she went on, more or less to herself, "you'd get thinner and thinner, and shrink, and in the end you'd be just bones. I've seen someone who was just bones, and he was called a skellington, and he was dead." Even now William failed to see the warning signals. "That's quite right, Daisy," he told her solemnly. "So you see what an important job you'll be doing. It's a matter of life and death." This stark summary of the position clinched the matter. "I don't think I will, thank you, Willem," she said politely. "You see, I only ever seen one skellington, and I never even saw him properly. And when you're a skellington, I can come and look at your bones really properly, and I can write a poem about them." William cursed inwardly, and would dearly have liked to make Daisy herself a candidate for an elegy. He did not, however, as a Bagthorpe, give up. He had a sudden inspiration. "I bet you were really upset when you lost all your maggots," he said. Daisy nodded sadly. "I was. I cried. I cried so much I thought Mummy would get me some more, but she wouldn't, and Daddy wouldn't either." "I don't expect they could," he told her. "You need magic to make maggots, Daisy, and there's only really me knows how to do it." "Magic?" Daisy's eyes widened, and William saw that he had made a breakthrough. The combination of magic and maggots was going to prove irresistible. "Can you magic maggots, Willem?" "I could," he said. "It would depend." Daisy caught his drift instantly. He was using a technique she sometimes used herself, having been taught it by Grandma. "I will fetch the trays, Willem," she said, "and I really will try and remember. Can I have a lot of maggots? Can I have them now?" "Not now," he said. "It's not instant magic. But I'll make them as soon as I can, I promise." The deal was thus sealed, and William set for his record-breaking attempt. He fetched some cold meat and set it in the airing cupboard to produce Daisy's eventual reward. At lunch he announced to his family that this would be the last meal he would be taking with them for some time. He also handed his mother a statement.